She went up and found a wider space, more internal doors, a locker room of sorts, and another with windows and desks and computers. It seemed deserted. She would have passed it by, but she glimpsed her own jacket hanging over the back of a chair. She set her teeth, muttering to herself about people who stole her shit, and burst through the door. There was no sign of her laptop, but she caught up the jacket, feeling the weight of it. Jersey Stern's journal was still nestled in the lining. Good. They weren't having that, at least, whoever they were. She put a little pressure on her left breast and felt the little key digging into her skin. Despite the electrodes they'd positioned to monitor her life signs, they apparently hadn't searched her that thoroughly. Also good. She followed the corridor round and came to an elevator. She considered it. If her escape had been announced, and she was sure it would have been, using the elevator might leave her trapped between floors. She looked for stairs and found instead a narrow shaft with a ladder set into the concrete. I guess we go up, she muttered to herself, unenthusiastically. The rungs were solid, smooth, and rust-free. But Tamika didn't like heights. She took a long breath, glanced back along the empty hallway to see if she was being pursued, and started to climb. She counted the rungs as she went, not looking down, trying to figure out how high she was. At 30 rungs, she figured she'd gone at least 2 stories. The end was in sight. 44 rungs brought her to a small concrete chamber with a metal door. It will be locked, she thought, desperately, and I'll have to go back down. But it wasn't. The door was, she guessed, an emergency exit, and barred on the inside. She released the bar, turned the mechanism with difficulty, and dragged the heavy squeaking door open. She was greeted with a howl of cold and a dusting of snow that made no sense at all. It had been chilly in Pennsylvania, considering it was supposed to be spring. But this? She was outside. But where? As she stepped clear, she looked back. The iron hatch gave onto what looked like a concrete hut, and nothing more. There was no sign of the complex she'd been in below ground. Above it were trees and a road. But these were not the trees or road of the Pennsylvania forest where she'd been abducted. The trees were closely packed hardwoods, silver-barked and heavy with snow. A wild and vast forest, traversed by a road quite unlike the one she'd been driving on. That had been a narrow ribbon of blacktop, with lane markings that wound leisurely through the woods in an undulating wave as the ground rose and fell. This was a dirt track, rutted but straight, shooting arrow-like through miles and miles of unbroken woodland. And the cold, the deep snow? It made no sense. She shrugged her way into her jacket and looked around. Lose yourself in the woods or follow the road, and if the latter, which way? 100 yards or so along the track was a signpost. She trudged through the softness of the freshly fallen snow, rounded the sign, and peered up. It was yellow and battered, so that the bare metal shone through, and the words on it were Greek? Russian? Something like that. 3 lines of unfamiliar letters and exclamation points. She stared at it. Where the hell was she? And more to the point, how was she going to get out? The road showed no tire tracks. If she set off walking, how far would she make it before she froze to death? She considered the long, straight road through the trees, and the answer floated back to her with a chill certainty. Not far enough. She thought furiously. Whatever the facility was, there were people here. That meant supplies and ways of getting them in and out. In other words, vehicles. Somewhere. She'd come up the ladder shaft, but there had also been an elevator, too. Where did that come out? She turned around and saw, just beyond the concrete shaft, where a second road, almost obliterated by the snow, cut back toward the underground facility. She took it, her pace quickening. She'd gone no more than 40 yards, when the trees to her left opened up, and she saw, set back from the road and concealed behind a row of trees, a concrete bunker with a wide roll-up door and a collection of concrete buildings behind it. One sprouted a pair of radio masts and 3 oversized satellite dishes. Parked alongside it was a pair of pickup trucks and a snowcat with skis at the front and caterpillar tracks in back. Jackpot. Of course she'd need keys. It was too much to hope that her abductors had left the doors unlocked and the keys tucked behind the driver's vanity mirror. But if they hadn't, the prospect of going back inside the concrete bunkers with its alien-suited people made her flesh creep. Perhaps if she went back to the ladder.
Stop! No chevelis!
She turned to find a soldier in gray and white camo, legs shoulder-width apart, some kind of automatic rifle with a banana clip shouldered and trained directly on her. He was young and pale, his face pink from the cold. He wore a fur hat instead of a helmet, but his camo was clearly a uniform, and the points of color on his shoulders and collar were insignia of some sort. She stood very still, her hands rising behind her head. The soldier called out again, over his shoulder this time, and 2 more soldiers appeared, one with a pistol, the other armed like the first. The one with the pistol pulled a lapel radio close to his mouth and spoke hurriedly into it. Tameka stood very still, dimly aware that it was snowing again, small icy flakes that blew purposefully in the stiff breeze. She turned only fractionally as she heard the garage door at her back roll up. 2 sets of feet, a man and her. The woman who had been one of the aliens down below. She was wearing ordinary clothes now, but the eyes were the same as before. Cool, blue. Before, they had been frightened. They were now hard with anger. She muttered a few words to the man hurrying to catch her up. Russian? Tameka thought so. She was in Russia. Probably Siberia, from the looks of it. The woman's eyes stayed locked on her prisoner. The wind blew her hair in her face, and she whipped it aside, her gaze freezing hard as she strode closer. Tameka watched the eyes, so she did not see the hand with the syringe before it was too late. The woman jabbed her once, a quick, precise, and practiced gesture that found her neck a second before the man beside her took hold of Tamika's hands, so she could no longer resist. The world went white. 46. Jersey. Parque Teocoare, Argentina. October 1946. In the end, I opted to get away from the abandoned jungle compound and go back to Buenos Aires as soon as possible. Ignacio and I fashioned a stretcher from bedding we found in the stone complex and 2 lengths of pipe, and carried Belasco back to the car. We made him as comfortable as we could, aided at the first village we came to by the locals who gave him leaves to chew on that eased his pain and made him sleep. And then we drove as fast as we dared on the rutted forest road. We made good time, eating as we rode, and stopping only for gas in a huddle of buildings, grandly titled Uruguayana. It was almost dark by then, but the roads were better as we left the high woodlands behind and kept going. South of Salto, we pulled over for a couple of hours, but we did not pitch the tent, and most of the time I sat awake, monitoring Velasco and watching the skies. I saw nothing unusual in the heavens. At dawn, we pressed on, reaching the city by lunchtime. As we headed south, an anxiety that the Kitchener might have already sailed swelled in my gut. Having to slow for the traffic, after having the road to ourselves, was doubly frustrating. Turning one corner recklessly fast got us the attention of a military policeman on a motorcycle, who sped up beside us and waved us over. But as soon as he saw our situation, he put his siren on and drove in front of the car, clearing the road. He led us not to the dock, but to a hospital, where we unloaded Belasco into the care of some crisply dressed nurses. He was awake enough to wink at one of them, then gave me a fractional nod of acknowledgement before I jumped back into the car and headed down to the quay. Captain Jennings, alerted by the hospital, was waiting for us. He listened to my story in silence, showing not the slightest trace of emotion, except when I told him about Hartsfeld, when his eyebrows arched and he turned away from me, his head bent in contemplation. The chart of Antarctica seemed not to surprise him at all.
"You knew," I said.
"No," he said, "but I had been warned that there was a possibility of this."
"This being?"
"A Nazi base," he said. "They went to Antarctica before the war, claimed a portion of it, which they named Neuschwabenland. Supposedly, the mission was to look for places they could hunt whales. Whale oil is used in margarine and various other products, but they were really looking for somewhere to build a naval base. Planted little swastika flags in the ice and everything." He unrolled the chart on the tabletop and pinpointed a spot with his finger. "The Schirmacher Oasis," he said. "Named after the guy who spotted it during one of their aerial recon missions. An area above the ice shelf, fairly temperate by Antarctic standards."
"You know a lot about it," I said, annoyed that so much had been kept from me.
"Mostly learned since you left," he said. "This is all top secret. Even if I had known before you went, I wouldn't have been allowed to tell you. And now you know. So it's water under the bridge."
"And Hartsfeld?" I demanded. "You know about him, too?"
"Only suspicions, which I voiced to you. It could have been any number of people who were helping the Nazis slip through our nets."
"Sounds like they're doing more than escaping," I said.
"Yes," he conceded. "It does."
"There's something else," I said.
I hadn't mentioned the strange end to the firefight in the jungle, the light in the sky, or the one I had seen the night before, which Hartsfeld had said was a meteor. Something took them away. Something that came at night, flying in silence. It hovered over the hideout, and then there was a light, and I lost consciousness. When I woke up, they were all gone.
Captain Jennings' eyes narrowed, and he became very still, but said nothing for a long moment. At last, he simply nodded and said, "Anything else? Do you remember any other details?"
"No," I said. "What do you think it was?" For a second, he looked vague, his eyes not clearly focused on anything.
"Probably a helicopter," he said. "You've never seen one, I take it. Remarkable things."
I was about to respond when he turned sharply away and, with his back to me, said,
"Thank you, Seaman. Good work. That will be all."
I had no right to be outraged, of course. I was about as junior as it was possible to be, and he was my commanding officer. I suppose he had also become a kind of parent to me, since I had no one else. But after what I'd gone through in the jungle, I felt he owed me more than this. I just stood there, not knowing what to say, what to think. And then he turned and put a hand on my shoulder. For a moment, I nearly shrank away, but then I nodded, saying nothing.
"You should go rest up," he said. "Take a couple of days. When the order comes, we'll need to sail quickly."
I looked at him.
"There?"
I said, indicating the map. The prospect of going back into combat, fighting a war the world thought was over, in the freezing waters of the Antarctic, was too exhausting to contemplate.
"I have to talk to Admiral Byrd," he said. "But that's my guess."
"Yes." Rear Admiral Richard E. Byrd was an explorer who had been to the Antarctic several times before. His first expedition in the 1920s
that involved a flight to the South Pole itself in a Ford trimotor, during which he'd had to ditch supplies and fuel tanks to maintain altitude. Partly as a result, he was made an admiral at 40, the youngest in the history of the U.S. Navy. During the war, he led recon missions in the South Pacific, scouting for land that might be used as airfields and forward command bases, that he had, it was said, been present at the surrender of the Japanese. A hero and a big shot, in other words, who was involved in important things, and he did nothing by halves. Whatever Byrd had been planning, the operation had been in its preliminary stages long before the details of our experiences near the Paraguay border could be relayed to him, and I never learned how much our findings shaped the mission to come. What was clear is that Captain Jennings' report gave the Enterprise new focus and urgency, as did seasonal conditions. The window in which the Antarctic was accessible, before the Southern Hemisphere winter made any kind of exploration there impossible, was very narrow. We holed up in Buenos Aires for 2 more weeks before the Kitchener set sail to meet up with the rest of the fleet. By the time Byrd's armada had been assembled, Task Force 68, approaching the Antarctic from both the west through the Marquesas Islands, where weather stations were set up, in the east, from an island called Peter I, off the western coast of the Antarctic Peninsula. The armada consisted of over 4,000 men and 13 ships, with 33 aircraft at their disposal, most of them based on the aircraft carrier USS Philippine Sea. Given the battle-weary condition of the military so soon after the war, and the growing anxiety about the standoff with the Bolsheviks in Europe, it was a massive deployment of naval power, or what must have seemed, to the outside world, to be a bewilderingly unimportant spot of the globe. Everyone was in position a few days before Christmas. I say that the weather was warming up, but that was a relative concept. The Antarctic, as my winter reading had revealed, was covered by an ice sheet a mile thick year-round. The South Pole proper never warms above minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit. The Antarctic coasts weren't that cold, and the west, our targeted destination, was warmer than the more mountainous east. Summer temperatures still tended to be below freezing. Much of the continent is also technically a desert, with little or no precipitation. The snow on the ground is ancient, gradually becoming part of the ice sheet. Though my Polish blood was keen to escape the sweltering weather of the tropics, the prospect of heading to the South Pole was daunting. Belasco had made a complete recovery, and though he was still his crass, boorish self, quick to anger and contemptuous of anything he couldn't drink or bed, he had decided I was to be protected, as one might look after a fragile pet who could not forage for itself. He brought me chocolate when he had it, even books, a bizarrely random assortment of classics, westerns, and smut, which was probably illegal, and he made it clear to the other bullies on board that I was to be unmolested. This raised eyebrows, and because we could not discuss what had happened to us in the jungle, some assumed that he had taken a particular kind of fancy to me, such as sometimes happens on ships. When a corn-fed Kansas boy made the mistake of suggesting as much to his face, Belasco beat him senseless with a chair. No one made the insinuation again. It was ironic, because I had my own suspicions about Belasco that ran contrary to his ostentatious womanizing. Not that it mattered to me either way. The cold of the Antarctic was impossible to prepare for, despite all my reading. It was bitter, bone-chilling, and constant. If it fluctuated much, you couldn't tell, as your senses could not distinguish variations so far beyond human tolerance. The only thing you could do was stay out of the wind. The cold wasn't the only environmental hazard. After a few weeks of 24-hour daylight, forcing your body to sleep on a schedule it refuses to recognize, going to bed with the sun in the sky, and getting up with the same sun still in the same sky, It felt like you were going insane. The mission went well at first. Bird took the first flight himself, using the JATO rocket assist tubes to help get the plane airborne. Soon there was a steady stream of sorties, day after day, though it wasn't clear what they were doing. Mapping, we were told. But the flying boats went up with P-51 escort fighters, despite the fact that the only things that lived down there at the bottom of the world were skuas, terns, and penguins. There were indeed whales and seals in the frigid waters, but nothing and no one on land, or so we were told. I saw Captain Jennings only a few times in those first few days, and he kept his distance, which was fine by me. After what had happened in the jungle, I was content to be a regular seaman for once. The appeal of secrecy had worn off. Then things took a turn for the worse, and I was reminded why we were really here. We lost one of the flying boats on the 30th of December. It was a Martin Mariner, what they called a PBM, patrol bomber, and it went down with its 9-man crew in heavy weather. Mariners are a rugged, versatile airframe, adaptable to all kinds of specialized roles, from recon and air-sea rescue to anti-submarine assault. But we never knew what equipment the flying boats were carrying. What I knew firsthand was that the Mariner that had gone down had been accompanied by a pair of P-51 Mustangs. Although they made it back to the USS Philippine Sea, they'd been pretty badly carved up. The official report said weather. Belasco said otherwise. He had a buddy on one of the repair and refueling tenders who said the Mustangs had holes through their fuselage and wings. Big round holes, the kind made by Sirius cannon, 20 millimeter or larger. The fighters were lucky to have gotten back at all. The pilots had been sequestered for debriefing, and the planes had been sealed up below deck while they were repaired, off limits to all but top brass. Meanwhile, a search and rescue operation was mounted for the Mariner's 9-man crew, an operation that required a ground team as well as air support, because the Mariner had gone down over land, possibly affecting a crash landing. Jennings volunteered me and Belasco. I wasn't angry, and I knew why he had done it, but I needed to hear it from him. I was summoned to the captain's quarters that evening, and he didn't beat around the bush. "Why me?" I said. "Because you've already seen," said Jennings. "Seen what?" "The Nazi presence here. Nocturnal airlifts and charts of Antarctica."
"Airlifts?
How else did Hartsfeld and his Nazi cronies evacuate, except by helicopter?" We'd gone over this before. I hadn't seen helicopters in operation. The Nazis and the Allies both had a few in service during the war, but they'd been rare and specialist aircraft. I found it hard to believe that that was what I'd seen in the jungle that night during the firefight at the Nazi compound. But Jennings assured me it couldn't have been anything else. "Is that the only reason?" I asked. "To keep the knowledge among those who already have some awareness of it?" "That's a big part of it," he said. "But in your case, there's more."
"Like what?"
He drew a manila envelope from a drawer and slid out a series of large aerial photographs. These were taken on the mission, prior to the one when we lost the PBM, he said. It was going back for a second look. We were mapping an area that's warmer than most of the region and accessible by inlets. Natural harbors, suitable for use as such, assuming they haven't already been claimed. But look here. Seen this before? He pointed to a ring, darker than the icy ground beneath it. It was perfectly symmetrical, man-made. And then, when he showed me the enlarged version of a different picture, one taken not from directly overhead, but at a shallower angle. The awful familiarity of the thing was clear. "We know the Nazis were working on an atomic weapon at the end of the war," he said. "Based on this, we think they still are." I stared at the picture. It was what I had come to think of as a hinge, a circle of pillars, probably concrete, connected at the top to a ring, run with cables and charged from beneath. I saw it all in my head, the peculiar underground chamber with the bell-like structure, the ladders up the side of the hinge, the men, the gunfire. Ishmael. Yes, I said. I will go. The weather was getting worse. The brief window of what we laughably referred to as the Antarctic summer seemed to be closing earlier than expected, and the sailors discussed the possibility that the mission would be abandoned sooner than had been scheduled. And of course, no one could survive out there for long. If a rescue of the surviving PBM crew members was to take place, it was going to have to be soon. Jennings confided that the Mustangs had indeed taken fire, but the weather had been so bad that they couldn't be sure whether the guns had been mounted on the ground or had come from hostile aircraft. No definitive sign of a runway had been discovered so far. That meant that we did not dare go too close to the site where the Mariner had gone down, for fear of straying into the same AA fire. Velasco and I were to be ferried to the icebreaker USCGC Northwind, then fly in a Coast Guard helicopter to a drop point 2 miles from where the PBM came down, meet up with the rest of the team, and cover the rest of the ground on foot. Again, I'd never so much as seen a helicopter up close, let alone ridden in one, and I will admit to being scared. Compared to planes, they felt slow and fragile, easy to shoot down, and we stayed terrifyingly low, so that it seemed a single gust of wind would flip us into the gray freezing waves. I gripped my seat all the way and tried not to stare into Belasco's massive and malicious grin. He was cradling a Thompson submachine gun in his lap, for all I know, the same one Hartsfeld had tampered with when we were in the jungle. He seemed quite content, like it was all a bit of fun, not worried about what might be waiting for us on the ice. Including me, there were 18 men on the ground, led by a pair of rangers, and 2 radio men who'd been ashore already, and a dog sled team for the equipment. We were to move inland from the edge of the Ross Sea toward the Queen Alexandria Range. We wore scarves around our faces, and fur-lined gloves and boots, so that we looked like lost Cossacks. No one talked much. Even the dogs went quiet once we started moving. And though it was slow and heavy going, the ground underfoot was hard, and the forced march generated as much warmth as I'd felt in weeks. We'd been walking for a little over an hour when we heard fighters coming in, with 2 more of the Mariner flying boats, the latter low and slow, scanning the ground, the Mustangs up high, circling, waiting. We slowed as we navigated an icy shelf that canted up toward the mountains, and paused on the top to see what we could see. There was a depression in the ice, a stretch of tundra that ran for a couple of miles to the mountains, then shot up in a steep impassable wall of rock. It was latticed by shining icy ridges, any one of which might be cover for a base of some kind. One of the Mariners made a particularly low pass, but suddenly it was pulling up steeply. "They've seen something," said Belasco. "Or something has seen them," said someone else. There was a crackle of gunfire, and we all shrank instinctively. Then the radio was blaring, and the Mustangs were streaming in, and we were moving again, running now, down and up the next rise, until I could see it. A huddle of nondescript buildings, and the great concrete henge in the center. Out of its ring, rising slowly, was an impossible ship, disc-shaped but bulging in the center, which flashed with glass. It rose vertically, soundlessly, and 2 ports beneath the windows flared as its guns opened up. The Mariner labored to get clear, and the disc craft gave chase, quickly hitting a rapid cruising speed, so that it was on top of the flying boat in seconds. Only as it wheeled to fire did I see the swastika stenciled on the side. 47. Tommy Resnick, Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana, March 16, 1967. Tommy Resnick figured he'd landed the cushiest job in the services, at a time when the alternatives could have been a whole lot worse. According to the paper, the House Appropriations Committee had just approved another $12 billion to satisfy President Johnson's demands for security concerns. In other words, for the war. This was on top of the $60 billion that had already been assigned for the year. $60 billion to get them through the year had got them as far as March. But now President Johnson's people were saying there was no end in sight. Robert Kennedy, senator from New York and brother to the late President John F. Kennedy, was saying the U.S. needed to pull out and go back to the conference table. Tommy wasn't so sure what he made of that. It sounded like defeat, but then they had been fighting in the jungle for years already, and it sounded to him like the mess was just getting worse. It had started quietly when Tommy was a kid in Cleveland, so quietly he barely remembered it. Gradually, the word had started to echo from every radio, every TV set. Vietnam. It felt constant, like an itch that wouldn't go away. Except that it was more than an itch. It was a fire, and it was spreading, getting hotter. It was terrifying. When Tommy enlisted in the Air Force, rather than letting himself get drafted into the Army, he thanked his lucky stars he was in Montana, under the big open American sky, and not huddled in some soaking jungle trench, waiting for some guy in black pajamas to run a bayonet through his guts as he slept. He stared up at the sky to banish the image, the great velvety black canopy with its constellations scattered like glitter. The long night patrols around the base perimeter were tedious, but hell, there were worse places to be. He hugged his parka, stamped his bunny boots for warmth, and hummed the opening bars of the Beach Boys' Wouldn't It Be Nice. It wasn't unusual to see shooting stars up there, and Tommy, born and raised a city boy from Cleveland, a place that always seemed shrouded in smog and street lamp glare, still marveled at them. But the one he saw now was something special. It had moved steadily across the sky from roughly east to west, but then it seemed to slow, changing direction quickly twice, executing a rough circle before coming to rest like the Star of Bethlehem, right overhead. Tommy stared. It wasn't a star, shooting or otherwise. That much was obvious. But there was no sound in the still Montana night, and its initial approach had surely been too fast to be a helicopter. You could sometimes see satellites, like Echo. He remembered Sputnik, the satellite the Ruskies had sent up when Tommy was 8 years old, and had found his parents sitting by the radio, white-faced, holding hands. But satellites didn't move like this. They didn't change directions and hover. There had been missions sending men into space, of course, again chasing the Ruskies who had beaten them to it. But after the Apollo disaster in January, when all the astronauts had burned before takeoff, Tommy wasn't sure that would ever happen again. Which meant that what he was seeing wasn't a U.S. spacecraft. And that meant Soviet, because no one else could do it, and that was very bad news indeed. Tommy's private nightmares were all about the jungles of Vietnam, a place he couldn't find on a map, and that lived in the whispered horror stories he heard among the men who had been out there and seen it. But the nation's nightmare was the Russian commies, an enemy they were fighting by proxy in Nam, but who were an altogether different kind of scary. The kind of scary that demanded bases like Malmstrom. Tommy's patrols were routine, but they were also meticulous, like everything else at Strategic Air Command. You had to be careful around nuclear missiles, and that was what was pointing skyward in the 10 silos of Oscar Flight, only a few hundred yards from where he stood. Tommy was part of the Combat Support Group, located some 30 miles east of Lewiston, one of five launch control facilities in the area that formed the 490th Missile Squadron, each equipped with 10 Minuteman I nuclear-armed intercontinental ballistic missiles. Tommy moved close to the perimeter fence and gazed upward, the Beach Boys' song momentarily forgotten, as he unslung his ANPRC-6 banana walkie-talkie and turned it to broadcast.
Base, this is Airman Resnick. Come in. Over.
There was a momentary silence, then a crackle, and the radio came to life.
Right here, Resnick. What's on your mind? Over.
Got a weird light in the sky, just outside the northeast perimeter fence. Over.
What do you mean, weird?
Over.
Moving erratically, hovering.
I don't know. Weird.
Over.
Okay. Not sure what to do with that, Resnick. Let us know if it gets weirder, I guess. Over and out.
Tommy could hear the amusement in the squad leader's voice, and he hesitated before retrying.
Airman Resnick again. I think you should come see this. Over, he said.
The silence was longer this time, and the voice, when it came, less amused.
Be right there, Resnick. Make sure the site is secure. I will alert command post. Over and out.
Tommy bit his lip. He wasn't sure he was ready to start a panic down in the launch bunker. But it was protocol that the duty officers sitting in the launch capsule be made aware of any security concerns, however preliminary. Someone would have to come and give the okay before getting back on the phone and calling down to the officers 60 feet below ground. It would all be officially recorded and documented. Tommy chewed his lower lip nervously. His breath billowed clouds of steam into the cold night air. He had to keep his nose clean. He was a good airman, reliable, punctual, always in control of himself. He didn't need a mark on his record, saying he was some Ohio rube who imagined stuff or cried wolf. If he called the base quickly, told him he'd made a mistake, he might head off any call down to launch control, and it might not make it into his record. But the light was still there, and as he watched, it moved, getting lower as it swept out toward the main gate of the launch facility. Canceling the alert was not an option. Tommy broke into a jog in the direction of the light, talking into the walkie-talkie as he did so.
Base, this is Resnick. Come in. Over.
Still here, Resnick. What's up?
Over.
The light is coming your way. Over.
Another momentary hesitation.
Say again. Over.
It's coming down and heading for the main gate. Over,
said Tommy, who was now running, his rifle bouncing on its shoulder strap. The light was larger now, and had gone from cold white to a burning orange that shone on the 8-foot fence and lit the ground like a forest fire. It moved again, drifting closer and closer until, quite slowly, it moved over the gate. It was hard to tell how big it was. The light seemed to fluctuate and spread, so that Tommy wasn't sure of the outlines of the object inside the light. He had the impression of looking at something about the length of an El Camino or a Plymouth Barracuda, though it was circular, disc-shaped. He could see no jets, no rotors, no means of keeping the thing up. It remained eerily soundless. It continued its steady slide through the air over the gate, no more than 30 or 40 feet above the ground, he thought. Suddenly the air was torn by sirens as the Russian craft, if that were indeed what it was, started tripping sensors all over the base. Over from the far side of the road, he could see 4 or 5 other guards moving quickly, heads turned upward, weapons at the ready. As cold dread settled into the hollow of his gut, Tommy did the same, dropping to one knee, as Sergeant Pinter, the NCOIC he'd been talking to on the walkie-talkie, came scuttling over to him, his eyes wide and scared. Pinter outranked him, something Tommy had resented until about 5 seconds ago. Now he couldn't imagine anything worse than being the guy who had to decide what to do next.
"Get over to the comm station," said Pinter, trying to look sure of himself not quite pulling it off. Call security and tell them what's going on.
Okay, said Tommy, though he hesitated just long enough to add, what is going on?
Pinter, whose eyes had not left the amber glow overhead, shook his head.
Damned if I know, he said.
Tommy ran clumsily, still looking up, unable to believe what he was seeing. When he reached the phone and snatched it off the hook, his hand was unsteady.
What the hell is going on up there?
Demanded Lieutenant Salas, the intercept control officer.
Sir, we've got a glowing red object right over the gate. It's just floating there. We're ready to engage, but...
But what?
I'm not sure that would be... wise.
He wasn't sure why he said it. It was just a hunch.
Well, you're going to need to do something, said Salas.
Tommy could hear another man's voice in the background, exclamations of astonishment and panic from down on the launch bunker.
What's happening, sir? Asked Tommy.
Well, I don't have a clue, said Salas. But whatever that thing is, it's shutting down our guidance systems. Every missile just went off alert and no go, one by one. This facility's capacity to launch a nuclear strike was just switched off.
Oscar Flight wasn't the only facility where the missiles went down that night. 50 miles away, Tommy later discovered, the weapons of Echo Flight also shut down, one by one, despite the fact that each missile was separately controlled and powered by its own generator. Something similar had, it turned out, happened at Minot Base almost a year earlier. The missiles were taken offline and examined. All were deemed to be fully functional, and no explanation for their going down could be found. No one died. No missiles launched. The glowing object simply left. And the base eventually went back to normal. Or at least its systems did. Its machines. The men did not. Though the morning came without the disasters the night had threatened, the guards were all haunted by what they had seen. They were never debriefed. And though they had made formal reports, all investigations as to what had happened were abruptly terminated, and everyone involved forced to sign non-disclosure documents. The guards were reassigned, split up, scattered into other parts of the service, which for some meant the change of nightmares. Tommy Resnick received his orders in April. By June, he had deployed to Tan Sonut Air Base, Saigon, where he died when the base came under attack during the Tet Offensive of the following year. He never told a living soul what he had seen in the skies over Montana.
48. Jennifer. Rachel, Nevada. She was still mad about the guy in the bar, or rather about the way she'd behaved. Or something. Maybe she was just mad. She'd sat eating her food, drinking her beer, watching the sun go down through the plate glass windows, ignoring the other few stragglers who came in to drink and chat. And she was acutely aware of the bandaged man called Alan, sitting at the bar by himself in his private cloud. When she felt the urge to apologize getting the better of her, she left without a word. She hadn't actually said anything she didn't believe, but it had been unnecessarily confrontational of her to say it. She left to escape the bar, not because she had anywhere better to go. She sat in the rented Chevy, with no idea what she was going to do next. She'd considered spending the night at the Little Ali Inn, but she couldn't face talking to the waitress who she'd snapped at, and who, she worried, was also the owner. She also knew that Alan might be able to see her rental car from where he sat inside the bar, so she drove off quickly. Wouldn't want to look indecisive. That's so typical of you, she scolded herself. Backing yourself into a corner, forcing your own hand. Out of what? Defiance? Pride? Fuck off, she muttered to herself. It was surprisingly dark. The English spring days, being further north, lengthened gradually, so that by midsummer, the evening unfolded over several hours. She'd been unprepared for how quickly day became night here. Now she was driving with her high beams on, wondering where the hell she was going.
A sign to her left flashed white in the dark. Red letters shouted, "Warning." She slowed to read the small print. Military installation. Trespassing prohibited. Photography prohibited. She sped away, her anger cresting once more, as she felt the presence of the impervious monoliths she'd always fought against. Authority. Control. Private interest. Exploitation of the masses. It was all here. She could smell it on the night air, like blood. "Your temper will be the death of you," she thought. But she heard her father's voice. "So impulsive, so quick to fight." "I said, fuck off," she shouted, stepping hard on the accelerator, as if to emphasize the point. But for all her bravado, the point was a good one. Her bullheadedness had got her where exactly, since she'd run from Latrange in the fields outside Heathrow. Leeds that didn't go anywhere. And the death of a senator, perhaps because he was seen talking to her. If she were going to take any more chances, pick any more fights, they had to lead somewhere. The men in black had let her go with a surreal lecture and a warning. But next time, they might not be so bizarrely forgiving. Latrange hadn't been. She was lucky to be alive, she reminded herself. She should be very sure of what she was doing before putting herself in that kind of danger again. Specific risks, she thought. Productive danger. That was what she needed, if she wanted answers. She thought of the Hapsell's ranch, the single strand of barbed wire surrounding it, the way the EPA guys had driven around in circles, never pushing more than a mile or so into the old couple's curiously well-funded acreage. Wandering around there after dark sounded like a pretty specific risk. She drove along the road that ran around the edge of the Hapsell farm, looking for a place she might pull over where the car would not attract attention. And as she did, she thought about what Powers had said about unexplained aerial phenomena. It had sounded crazy then, and it still did. Though out here, where the world was so unfamiliar, it felt perhaps a little less crazy. The blackness of the night beyond her headlights was uncanny. In England, there would be hedges and trees flashing green, like walls on either side of her. But this strange openness here, an emptiness so complete her headlights found nothing but the asphalt strip and the sky, was unnerving. Whatever might be out there was impossible to see. Feels like a metaphor. The road was an image of what her life had become, a stumbling, half-blind pursuit of God knew what. And the only thing she was certain of was that her headlights would not find the one thing she really wanted, her father, walking back to meet her. But if she could find out what was going on, if she could connect the dots that led back to his death, maybe that would be something. Even though the idea that chasing down some half-baked nonsense about UFOs would give any insight into her father's life seemed too preposterous to seriously consider. Except, something had been pushing against her conscious mind, a half-memory, flexing against the dark membranes that kept it hidden. She'd been conscious of it for a few days now, but it hadn't registered as more than a kind of hunch, a pointer in the dark, a notion that there was something to see if she looked hard enough. Now there was more, though she didn't know what had knocked the memory loose. She'd been 6 years old, alone in her room and unable to get to sleep, because the skeleton man had been over for dinner and had tousled her hair in a way that made her want to scream. Herman Salzberg, her father's friend and a fellow board member at Maynard, had been their dinner guest, along with two other men whose names she did not recall. He'd sat there, grinning his skull grin, the skin of his hands painted on during the day, she'd decided, so no one would know what a monster of bones he was at night. She'd lain in bed, rigid with fear, waiting for the sounds of the front door and the house settling into sleep, and then she'd gone out, looking for her father, who would put her to bed properly and drive the memory of the skeleton man from her head. She looked in the train room, but hadn't found him, and had to stalk her way across the long corridor with the creaky floor to his office. She opened the door without knocking and stepped inside, finding him with his back to her, studying a chart on bluish paper pinned to the wall behind his desk. This was the detail her mind had buried, but she saw it now quite clearly, freed by her turning and returning of Senator Power's troubling phrase, unexplained aerial phenomena. The chart showed a curious shape that six-year-old Jennifer had thought was a kind of airplane, its details labeled with little words and numbers that she couldn't read. There were two images, one from in front, which reduced the craft, if that was what it was, to a long, slender line that bulged in the middle, and one from above, which showed it as a lightly rounded triangle. She remembered to this day, but not because the images had struck her as significant. She remembered because she'd started to speak, and her father had whirled round, his face a mask of fury, the likes of which she'd never seen. He snatched the chart from the wall, tearing it in the process, and yelled at her to get out, with such awful violence that it was like seeing a person she'd never met before. She fled to her room and locked herself in. The following morning, he apologized, but also said she must never enter his study without knocking again. She didn't feel like his apology was quite real. When he asked her what she'd seen on the chart above his desk, she'd lied, and told him she didn't have a chance to look at it. But she remembered that strange triangle, even if it never meant anything to her, except as a sign of her father's furious commitment to his work, which she preferred not to think about. She was thinking about it now, wonderingly, amazed that the memory had taken so long to surface, like something that had been lying beneath muddy water. There was a turnout and an outcropping of rock screening the road. It wasn't perfect, and would only hide the car from traffic coming from the west, but was the best she'd seen. She made the decision, and swerved hard, so that the car slewed slightly on the russet gravel. It was much cooler now that it was dark, and reminded her of Africa, and although she wouldn't have to worry about hippos or leopards, it occurred to her that the desert southward had a decent supply of venomous snakes, rattlers and the like. Did they hunt at night? She had no idea. Cold-blooded? Probably not. Caution, regardless. She took a small LED flashlight from the glove compartment, brought her purse, and climbed a crumbling dirt embankment. She swept the flashlight across the dry, tall grass and desert scrub, and saw the dull, rusty glow of the Hapsel fence. The wire was slack, and she could pull it low enough to climb over easily, shutting the light off so as not to attract attention. The moon was high and partial, but the sky positively blazed with stars, and once more reminded her of Africa. She found there was just enough light to see by, as long as she stayed out of the trees. She was about a mile south of the farmhouse. The Hapsel ranch was extensive, but the protected habitat was only a few square miles, bordered by a rocky ridge that ran, if you remember the Google Earth map, about 2 miles to the west. It took her an hour and a quarter, and though the night was a good deal cooler than the day, she was dripping with sweat by the time she mounted the wall-like escarpment and its clutter of EPA keep-out signs. The fence was not, as far as she could see, electrified, or draped in razor wire. But it was purposeful, new, and well-maintained. She could get over it, but it was designed to make it clear that doing so constituted a serious violation of law. One sign said that the territory was both under continual electronic surveillance and subject to security patrols. For a long moment, she read and reread the signs, scanned the perimeter for the telltale red lights of cameras or motion sensors. The longer she hesitated in the dark, the more her determination flagged. She could, she told herself, just walk away. She should. And then what? Fly back to England and spend the rest of her life on the lookout for Latrange? Or someone similar who thought she knew more than she did? That would be intolerable and insulting. She gazed into the darkness beyond the fence, and the same simple question floated back to her, with memories of her father's rage as he tore down the strange chart in his study. Dad? He wasn't out there, of course. Not really. But maybe if she could see what was out there, she would learn more about him, what he had done, and what he had tried to back away from or expose, and what had killed him. She set her teeth, pulled the cuffs of her shirt until she could wrap them around her fingers, and took hold of the wire. No electrical current, no unseen sharp edges. In seconds, she was over and running clumsily down the other side of the ridge, where the vegetation grew thicker, and the starlight glittered on a series of streams emerging, she assumed, from an underground spring. Whether there really were Ash Mountain speckled dace, she had no way of knowing. But the water supply had at least made those claims plausible. It also made her own progress more difficult, since she now had to splash around the water's edge in the dark, looking for places to cross, though since she didn't have a set destination, that didn't matter too much. But it was noisy moving around in the stream, and there was just enough reflected light off the water that she felt conspicuous. She headed deeper into the nature reserve and made for higher ground. The land was slashed by gullies and long stony shelves that rose like the ribs of some emaciated torso, so that Jennifer found herself climbing and then stumbling down the swollen succulents and stiff prickly plants over and over. On the fourth ridge, and still with no sign of any kind of facility or habitation, she opted to swing east along one of the ridges, skulking low to the ground in case anyone might be watching from below. There was a stand of low, twisted trees at one end, their bark smooth, their dry leaves pale and papery. She paused under them for a moment to scan the desert floor. Something stirred below her, a dog-like form picking its way through the grass 50 yards away. Wolf? She wondered, momentarily anxious. The animal moved away from her in a light trot, its body rangy and low to the ground, its ears back. Coyote, she decided, though the name meant little to her beyond Roadrunner cartoons. Maybe they were here, too. The idea pleased her, putting a lightness in her step that made her momentarily careless. The stone under her foot turned as she put her weight on it, and she lost her balance, falling on the baked earth and landing with one arm and the side of her face in a thorny, gorse-like plant. For a second, she lay still, eyes squeezed shut, her body shifting slightly to test how much damage she'd done. The pain in her face and hand shouted loudest, but she was sure the scratches were all superficial. The throb at her ankle was more worrying. She had rolled it, and it felt tender even as she lay on her back, looking at the sky. What would it be like when she got up and put some weight on it? A point of light flickered into view overhead, fast as a shooting star, but then, quite suddenly, still. It stayed where it was, so that she began to be sure she had imagined its previous movement. But then it was swelling, and the light, at first singular and pinkish, divided into three lights, equally spaced. A triangle, like the one on the chart in her father's study so many years before. The triangle stayed where it was for a moment, then seemed to grow bigger, spreading evenly across the blackness behind it. Jennifer stared, her brain hurrying to catch up. It was coming down. A pair of slim red needles of light lanced down from the craft and flickered over the land below like scribbling pens. They seemed to flit from point to point, as if they were searching for something, or mapping the contours of the ground. And Jennifer rolled to watch them, suppressing a gasp at the twinge in her ankle as she shifted onto her side. The red lasers vanished as quickly as they'd come, and now the triangle was dropping steadily and silently toward the floor of the shallow valley. It was impossible to tell just how high it was, until it was level with her, and she saw that what she had assumed was very large indeed, the size of a football pitch, say, was in fact not much bigger than a double-decker bus on its side. There was a fractional hum, less a sound than a kind of sensible vibration in the air, and then the mechanical thunk of what might have been landing gear. It hung for another 10 seconds before settling down soundlessly on the desert earth. There was no cover to speak of, but Jennifer was well hidden in the tangle of weeds and struck by something too close to awe to move a muscle. The craft had come down as if it weighed no more than gossamer, as if the laws of physics themselves had been suspended. It was like watching a magic trick, studying the conjurer's hands for a telltale sign of the reality behind the illusion, but finding nothing. And this was no stunt designed for an audience. This was true. She knew it, and not just because her eyes told her so. Again, she thought of the chart on her father's wall, and knew in her heart that the craft etched palely on that blue print had just landed on the Nevada dirt, only 50 yards or so from where she lay. The ship was dark now, because the light she'd seen came from its underside, and had dwindled to nothing as it had drifted lower than her vantage point. But as she watched, a new set of lights swelled around the triangle's edge, a soft amber glow that seemed somehow alive. She heard a series of dull clicks in a broken and uneven stream, and then the desert was white and green, every stunted plant and water-starved bush, casting long, hard-edged shadows. The blue-white glare came from beneath the craft itself, and it was so bright that, though she wanted to watch, Jennifer twisted her head away and shut her eyes. When she looked back, the ship was gone. It took her a moment to see the triangulated lights already getting small as the ship rose steadily into the night sky. The points of white pulsed once, and then it vanished, speeding away like a bolt of lightning arcing across the sky, then taking an impossibly hard cut to the west, and out of sight. For at least a minute, Jennifer did not move, and when she got to her feet at last, it was reluctantly, like she was the last person to leave a movie theater as the final credits rolled out and the house lights came up. Reluctant and uncertain. Those last few minutes had shaken her, challenging a lot of things she thought she knew about the world and her place in it. These thoughts would surely have swamped her, left her gazing up at the heavens until the sun rose, except that a sound from the valley below had caught her attention. A breathy grunt, a groan, as of exertion. Jennifer scoured the desert floor. There, just where the impossible triangle had just taken off, getting unsteadily to her feet, was a woman. 49. Alan. Rachel, Nevada. Alan had been nursing the same beer for over an hour, and as it warmed and turned flat, it had become, even by his undemanding standards, undrinkable. The waitress twice offered to get him another, but he'd shaken his head and tried to suggest, more kindly than the Englishwoman had, that he wanted to be left alone. She seemed to get the message. He pushed the glass to the edge of the table where it sat beside the phone he had turned off. He was not in the mood to talk to anyone. It was amazing, given all that had happened, that the English woman, Jennifer, she'd called herself, was in his head at all. But then her little speech, her accusation that he wasn't serving American freedoms, had gotten under his skin. On a night like this, when calls would be made to the parents and wives of soldiers who'd been lost on a classified mission somewhere, it needled him to think their sacrifices might be called into question. But it was worse than that. He'd heard such rants before, and had always been able to dismiss them. But this time, in this place, he was less sure. What if she was right? What exactly was he doing here? Who was he fighting? And on whose orders? He had never had a problem with the secrecy of a mission before. It made sense to him that military strategies and objectives should be kept from the public, lest the enemy learn of them and use that information to better their position. But the Locust program was a different kind of secrecy, in which everything, equipment, methodology, purpose, hell, even the nature of the enemy,